What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Sven Heinrich is the founder and lead market strategist at Northman Trader. In this conversation, we discuss the macro environment, how we got here, what central bank options are moving forward, what is the confidence game, and why some people are forced to buy overvalued assets. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well.
Skirt, skirt! Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit crypto.com. Pomp's got you always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it. It shows up at your doorstep. You pull it out of the box. You plug it in. Connect to your Wi-Fi. 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
As many of you know, crypto investors store their digital assets on exchanges or in cold storage for long-term safekeeping. However, this strategy doesn't help them grow their investment holdings or build overall wealth. With the new BlockFi interest account, users can now securely store their Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. 6% is an absurdly high rate. It's the best rate in the industry. I highly suggest you go check out BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, that's BlockFi.com/pomp to sign up and start earning crypto today.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I'm here with Sven. I'm super excited to do this. Yet again, we have somebody who understands both the crypto world and the macro economy. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this all the way over there in London.
Hey, Pom, glad to be with you. Looking forward to the conversation.
For sure. So maybe before we get into the macro conversation, just give us some background on yourself and kind of what you're doing today so we understand the perspective you're coming from.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I actually come from originally a corporate background, was in corporate development for a long time with large wireless companies who built out networks across the globe. So had a lot of international corporate development, then saw the startup phases of these businesses. So I always had a very analytical mind in terms of looking at businesses from the grounds up and get a realistic perspective, what is doable, what is not doable from a valuation perspective. Then always had an interest in markets myself as an investor, and then ultimately transitioned into a trading environment because I quite enjoyed it. And I found myself in Europe a few years ago and had a difficult time connecting with the financial world via the access I had there. And I ended up on Twitter, and Twitter is a fantastic medium to reach out to people and connect with people, and actually found that market analysis, especially independent market analysis, is actually a very, very highly appreciated commodity. I mean, obviously, we're all used to the standard Wall Street analysis and viewpoints, but I think social media in particular has opened up the opportunity for independent voices to come out and offer an alternate view, maybe even sometimes a much better perspective, as there's no conflicts of interest, if you will. And so we can be fairly unbiased. So that's what I've been doing for the last 6-7 years or so. And love it and enjoy it very much.
Very cool.
And so maybe let's get into the conversation with just kind of a state of where we are, right? I think that there's a lot of folks that are paying attention on Twitter. They're paying attention to some financial metrics. And I think they're getting the sense of there's some alarm bells going off, right? And we've kind of are on the end of what was one of the best bull markets in history. And you've said previously that it's almost like the economy is kind of hitting a wall. So maybe kind of just give us a, you know, where are we and how do you see that in the historical context of maybe the bull market that we've experienced for the last decade or so?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I mean, first of all, what we are, I think you have to view 2018 and 2019 as massively important years from a policy perspective. Last year, as you recall, we had initially the tax cuts in the early part of the year. There was a lot of optimism about growth coming. And of course, you know, we had all this liquidity from buybacks. And technically what happened was when yields rose to a particular point, specifically the 10-year reached around, roughly around 3.25%. Something dramatic happened from my perspective. What a lot of structural bears have been complaining about for the last 10 years is that, you know, this bull market has been financed by cheap money, by massive debt expansion. And the view was that at some point, there will be a time when actually you would see yields rise, that the entire debt structure cannot sustain itself, because obviously everything rises, right? If you accumulate massive debt, at some point your interest exposure becomes too high to be able to maintain that. And that's precisely what happened last year when the 10-year yield rose to 3.25%. The entire narrative literally fell apart. And actually, obviously we can't show this in a discussion here, but the 10-year hit a trend line, a technical trend line that it's hit ever since the 1980s. We've gone from a period of lower highs on yields. And central banks, in the same token, have reached or failed in their ability to ever reflate basically the system. They're forced to also capitulate, if you will, at ever lower highs. And to me, from a structural perspective, that is so fundamentally important, because we keep going from cycle to cycle to cycle in the same manner, right? We had the tech bubble, which ended up producing a massive crash. Then we had the housing bubble, which produced a massive crash. And each time the Fed had to react when these bubbles were created, and it had to drop rates. And of course, what happened in the last 10 years, we ended up at zero in the United States. We ended up negative in many places in the world, specifically Europe. And we've never been able to really reinflate again. And the Fed in the last few years, and I give them credit for that, they tried. They tried to raise rates again. They tried to reduce the balance sheet. And when they hit the wall in October, right, when the 10-year hit that wall, that game was basically up. The Fed tried to still maintain its credibility by raising rates in December, and it blew up in everybody's face, right? That's when we had that big, massive market sell-off. And obviously, since then, they've dramatically turned a 180 on their policy and have gone back from not only not raising rates to not raising rates to cutting rates, which is now the cycle that we're in. And just to maybe wrap this particular point up, we're finding ourselves in a position after 10 years where central banks across the globe have not been able to normalize. And I cannot emphasize enough how important this is, because as we approach a critical point here in the economy and maybe in valuations, if a global recession is to ensue, the ability of central banks to be effective in a policy response is greatly, greatly diminished. And this is what I called on Twitter and on my website also the confidence game, because a lot of this is wrapped around psychology. And as long as you're still in a cycle where unemployment is low and asset prices are high, you can maintain confidence. But if you get into a position where you have a larger equity sell-off, then you lose that confidence. And central banks are struggling with this right now because they don't know how to respond in any shape or form other than to pursue what they've done over the last 10 years, which is to cut rates again or even further and bring back asset purchases again. So that's kind of the macro backdrop of where we are. Critical phase, And it's a matter of control. Can central banks still provide enough juice and stimulus to extend the recovery that has been going on so long, or will they lose ultimately control and the macro wheels that are already turning globally will wrestle control away from central banks? And then we're faced with a global recession and bear market, if you will.
Yeah, it's funny because I saw you talking about recently, like this idea that historically the Fed raised rates during loose conditions and they cut the rates once the conditions tightened. That's not necessarily what's happening right now, right? And so you almost get this weird activity. And then what that leads to is if you already have low rates and we enter into a recessive period, that tool is essentially mitigated, right? It just doesn't have the impact that it historically has. And people have heard me talk about on the podcast before, in the last two recessions, the central banks cut interest rates by over 500 basis points, right? And obviously there's not 500 to cut today.
That's exactly it. And, you know, ECB is still on negative and they're talking about going more negative. I mean, this is just how absurd this all is. You mentioned the loose financial conditions. Yeah, the Fed cut rates in July with the loosest financial conditions in place in over the last 2.5 decades, since 1993. It's absurd. I mean, if you can't grow with the loosest financial conditions in decades, what does that tell you about the inherent structural strength of the economy underneath? I mean, look, the 2019 has been all about multiple expansion in assets. Why? Because of the Fed pivot, right? The Fed put, the central bank put, it's already inflated. It's already been run on the expectation that they're going to raise rates. But has it improved in any shape or form the growth equation? It has not, I submit, right? Where we still see slowing growth everywhere, even in the United States. And yet we can talk about trade wars and what the impact is of that. But the fact is, the global markets peaked in January of 2018. That was before the trade war. And the structural issues that are playing out in the economy, they will not go away no matter what they do at this point. So the only question is how much can they keep reinflating asset prices. And there's a point that I made recently that I kind of discovered on the fly myself, and that is, how do you recognize that you're in a bubble? And my view on this has been that one of the you can talk about sentiment and excitement and all this, but there's one point to be made about valuation, and that is how far do asset prices disconnect from the underlying size of the economy? And what I found was that if you look back at the big bubbles, 2000, 2007, asset prices, stock market values reached 146 to 140% above GDP, right? And that's each time they hit that wall, if you will. And we've just reached the same thing again in January 2018, in the fall of 2018, and again in July of 2019, around 145%. So we're already stretched, and we're stretched because there is an alternative, right? Money has to go somewhere. So to me, what will have to take place is for central banks to be successful here, they have to blow a bigger bubble than we have seen before in terms of that valuation disconnect.
For sure. And I guess as part of this, the other tool here that central banks have, obviously, is quantitative easing. And while they use that for almost a decade, there has been some relief from that. But I think that there's been multiple members of various central banks and governments who have basically either explicitly said or alluded to the fact that we're probably going to go back to that, and that's probably going to become the new normal, right? And I think that is another piece of, you know, if you have two tools, you can cut rates and print money, and you're kind of doing those, and then you hit the recessive period, you just don't have the tools available to you that were previously there, or at least they're not going to be as severe on impact as they previously have been.
Well, several points on this. I mean, we talked a little bit about rates, and let me start with the rate equation first. Because no one's normalized, no one's been able to get to a period where they have a lot of ammunition, they are left with a lot less ammunition. I found this, you know, with the Fed here in particular, fascinating. As you mentioned, 500 basis points were necessary in 2007. I think it was 550 in 2000. the now we're sitting at 225 basis points. So the Fed only raised rates 9 times since December of 2015. Historically, that's just not very much at all. It's not even half of what they were able to do in previous cycles before they are now back to cutting, which means now after this rate cut in July, they only have 8 cuts left before they're hitting zero bound, right? And with quantitative easing, you have the same issue. Yes, they reduced the balance sheet a bit, but Europe hasn't. I mean, the ECB ended QE in December, and they're sitting at 45% balance sheet to Eurozone GDP. These are still massive amounts of balance sheets. I think globally combined, we're close to, I may be wrong on the figure, but I think it's close to $18 trillion still. I mean, globally, if you look at the cumulative central bank balance sheets, that equation hasn't really changed. And I mentioned the global central banks because they do have an influence beyond their own borders, right? This whole equation is creating this thirst for yield. And so you get dislocations in terms of where capital goes. Just the prime example is the Swiss National Bank, the SNB, right? Tiny Switzerland has been printing money like you wouldn't believe if you look at the M1 money supply, and they've been using a lot of that money to invest in U.S. stocks. They're buying U.S. stocks directly and have a portfolio of almost $100 billion in FANG stocks, if you will, right? They own Apple, they own Google, they own Facebook. I mean, that's part of the liquidity equation as well. So, to where to go from here, I question the efficacy of it all. To me, it's a policy failure because they've never been able to grow. And keep in mind, originally, and this is, I think, another really critical point here, is when the financial crisis hit 2008, and they had to do what they did to rescue the global economy, and I totally get it, totally support it. I mean, we were hours away from all the major banks blowing up. They had no choice. Fair enough. Fully supportive of that. But the original premise, and this is where I go to the entire intellectual integrity of the construct, the original premise was that these were to be emergency measures, that we're going to do this temporarily, we're going to reflate the economy, and then ultimately we're going to normalize. That was the premise, and that turned out to be the big central bank lie, because they never did. In fact, the QE2 came, QE3 came, we had twist and all this in between. And then in 2016, and maybe just add to this historical perspective, we had an earnings recession in 2015, 2016. And we were kind of heading the way toward a recession back then. And this is when the period of the largest central bank intervention ever happened, not on the side of the Fed, but on the side of everybody else. And they added $5 trillion plus in intervention between 2016 and 2018. And guess what? When that stopped, global markets stopped rising. That was the end of the game. And that's why we've seen Europe and Asia and everybody else already disconnecting hard. And US markets actually not making much progress in the last year and a half at all. So what that basically shows is how much these markets continue to be dependent on the central bank put, this artificial liquidity put. And so then the fair question to ask, I suppose, in regards to what I mentioned with stock market values above GDP, what is fair value of these markets if they don't have this artificial intervention nonstop? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. These markets cannot do without, and as soon as they're left without, then big trouble.
For sure. And so this brings me to this idea of QE4, which I know that you've said will be very big. Maybe talk a little bit about what you mean by QE4 and kind of how you look at that, again, from like the historical comparisons to the past ones.
Well, we've been jokingly talking about QE4 for a couple of years on Twitter because ultimately that's where this is all heading, right? The Fed in their minutes this week actually talked about being proactive and what they call confidently experimenting with additional asset purchases, which tells me they're already talking about internally preparing for that moment, which is an interesting kind of communication faux pas, because and I call this the game of confidence. You know, the Fed's Daily was talking about yesterday also carefully gauging the mood, because you don't want people to stop spending, because that's ultimately what we are. You know, the U.S. economy, we see, you know, recessive or at least slowing trends in a lot of aspects, be it manufacturing, be it in agriculture, be it in, you know, all these pieces, and of course in earnings, but the U.S. consumer is still holding up. And know that in December, when markets dropped hard, retail sales dropped hard with them. There's a really close correlation now. That's why this emphasis on keeping U.S. consumer confidence high is very important. And when they flipped policy in January, when Powell came out with his, you know, flexible speech, and, you know, markets just ripped higher from there, that's when confidence came back, because asset prices rose again, right? When people see bad news and markets dropping, they get less confident, and it's a natural consequence. So the Fed now is very cognizant of this. And this is why when Powell came out in July about the rate cut, they did not want to let on that they may see darker times ahead, if you will, right? That's why they called it a mid-cycle adjustment, you know, like they did in the 90s. Don't worry, it's just a little adjustment. And therefore, you know, don't be concerned, don't lose confidence. Well, I'm sorry, if you're talking about a mid-cycle adjustment, as they did in their minutes as well, but at the same time you're talking about, you know, large-scale asset purchases, you know, you're talking on both sides of your mouth. You can't have your cake and eat it too. They are clearly worried about a recession coming. The stated objective by Powell is now to extend the business cycle. Because I think ultimately, and this is the biggest worry of all, how do you combat a recession? How do you deal with a recession where we have the largest corporate debt ever, the largest government debt ever, where 78% of people are literally living paycheck to paycheck? I mean, to me, that's the larger macro concern, because people have not saved, they don't have savings, they're completely dependent on their job. And here we are at 3.6, 3.7% unemployment at the end of a large cycle, and there is no safety net. There is no protection. You know, I think that has to worry everybody, you know, whether you're bullish or bearish. And, you know, when you look at, you know, 3.6% unemployment and things look great and debt looks manageable. Yeah, of course, it always looks great at the end of the cycle. It's what will it look like if we go back to 4, 5, 6, 7% unemployment? That's the big measure.
Absolutely. And so if you kind of continue on this trend around the world, right, that there's, you know, again, as I said in the beginning, these kind of warning signs or alarm bells that are going off. And so you get the negative yielding debt, talks of the negative rates, et cetera. And one of the things that I've seen you say that just absolutely cracked me up, but because it's so true, right? Every great joke has a hint of truth. You said, who's buying this stuff, right? just we're all on Twitter, you know, essentially mocking it and laughing about it and saying, like, what is happening? But there are people buying it. And so any ideas there as to, you know, who those people could be or why people would be buying this stuff?
Yeah, one of the things that I find fascinating, and I think that also everybody should be aware of in terms of the investing universe they find themselves in. We have buyers in markets for all kinds of asset classes that are forced to buy, that have no choice to buy, or that are completely price insensitive, right? Because you have, on the one hand, you got passive investments, right? Money just keeps flowing in into ETFs. ETFs track stocks, and they just keep allocating to the stocks. The biggest stocks get the biggest allocations, right? You have pension funds that have to meet certain returns, and they have certain legal obligations, and they just have to keep allocating. And so I think what's happening with the negative yield curve is a lot of that related. Oh, and the negative yields, they just have to allocate. And it's frightening, because that's a spiral that can keep going. And it's one of those maybe potential factors that could wrestle control away from central banks. You know, you always get to a point where it becomes systemic, right? When something you don't anticipate breaks the stability curve. And yields is a perfect example this year. In 2018, right, two things happened. Well, first, obviously, it was in the September-October timeframe. There were all these positive projections. Every major FANG got upgraded. Apple's going to this. This is going to that. And S&P is going to 3,200 and whatever. And then, of course, we ended up at 2,300 and the bottom fell out. At the same time, yields were projected to go significantly higher in 2019 based on the premises that were made in 2018. The range, I had a tweet on this one as well. There was a hilarious article in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago. You know, the projections were between 2.5% to 3.3% on the 10-year yield. Jamie Morgan, he was talking about 4% on the 10-year, even 5% last year. And this year, we ended up at 1.5%. What does that tell you? If this is the bond market, it's the largest market on the planet. And if everybody's getting the bond market wrong, then please, everybody step back and pause before making any more larger projections, because obviously there's something broken in everybody's forecasting model. The Fed the same way, right? I mean, they went from, hey, we're going to raise rates multiple times in 2019, and we're going to have our balance sheet roll off on autopilot, to completely flipping policy. And this is, maybe I go back to what I said at the very beginning. This is why there's a place for independent analysis, because maybe the systemic institutional analysis, like in 2007, just doesn't protect investors from seeing what is maybe coming down the pike. Remember, 2007, no one talked about financial crisis coming. Bernanke, right? The subprime is contained. There were no warnings. No one ever tells you to sell. No one. And that's when people get really, really hurt, when things break. Now, as long as things go up, it's fine. But as soon as something breaks, then obviously it's a big, big, big hurt factor for a lot of people.
For sure. And do you feel like the fact that I'll say everyone is talking about, but everyone probably being a very small portion of the world that just happens to be on financial Twitter, but so many people are talking about a potential recession or a market crash. Does that, to you, increase the odds that we won't have one, that we will have one? Do you think that there's no impact? You know, how do you kind of look at the idea that there are people who are paying attention to the alarm bells? I just don't know if it's the right people or if it's just the folks on Twitter.
Yeah, that's always the risk, that we're all kind of in our own echo chambers, right? We're exposed to certain people on social media. Look, I think the vast majority of people are not paying attention to any of this. I think part of it is driven by the fact, look, if you have a job and you're able to pay your bills and you see markets high, then you know your confidence is up. We actually still have very high consumer confidence, although it's just recently dipped a little bit, right? So you always have to watch out for that. If there was evidence of a real negative sentiment, we should be seeing it in the retail allocation data. There's a technical chart I follow, is the RightX fund allocations. And actually, I'm fascinated by that, because when you looked at like major corrections or bear markets in the past, you see the bull bear ratio spike there very significantly, right? That's when people get really negative, they panic, they sell. And what's been happening over the last 10 years, and this is the big unanswered question to your question, what I've seen over the last 10 years is the spikes have been getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Even in December, when we had a 20% rout, no one really reacted on the retail side. I mean, some people did, but people stayed largely invested, which turned out to be right for the moment. But to me, it's kind of suggestive of a high level of complacency in markets. Why is this the case? Because investors have been trained, so far rightly, that central banks will always be there and any sell-offs will be extremely short-lived, which is exactly what happened, right? When you look at the, I have a chart on that, posted a few times, that, which shows that whenever markets get in real trouble, there is intervention. And that's precisely where we stopped in December, the key trend line that we've been following for the last 10 years. This is when the Mnuchin liquidity calls came in and Powell's flipping on his speech. So investors have been right, but they've become very complacent. And this is why I'm kind of concerned about this whole systemic issue of it. If we get to a point where central banks do lose control, keep in mind that there's been a huge flip from active investing to passive investing. People have been given up on hedge funds. They've been given up on actively, you know, choosing vehicles, because even the professional hedge funds are struggling. They've been lagging, right? Because everything is so geared toward the few winning stocks, as opposed to maybe the broader stock universe, which is actually suffering. And that's actually one of the major technical points I'm concerned about, how the last year and a half has unfolded. So the ultimately point is, if you get to a point where central banks lose control and passive investors start to get concerned, you may have a flood of selling that we've never seen before. Because then the programs that keep automatically allocating cash, they're going to have to be doing the opposite. They're going to have to start selling. And they can't stop. It's the more sell orders they get, that's when you have that big problem, when everything kind of right sizes, if you will. But it could right size much more extreme to the downside. We're not there. Hasn't happened. I'm just observing that at this point, everything is still kind of hunky-dory from a retail investor point of view.
Skirt, skirt! Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, Crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at Crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit Crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always.
Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it. It shows up at your doorstep. You pull it out of the box. You plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi. 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
One more word from our sponsor, BlockFi. Their new interest account allows you to securely deposit your Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. This rate actually compounds, so you receive a 6.2% APY, which is very attractive given the alternatives. So you can actually take your Bitcoin, you can deposit it with BlockFi, and get paid an interest rate of 6% in return. Go check out BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, BlockFi.com/pomp. to sign up and start earning interest on your crypto today.
Before we get into Bitcoin and kind of some of the options that individuals have, I really look at it as the markets are the markets, right? They kind of, based on a whole bunch of things that kind of come together, the markets act the way that they do. And there's two market participant buckets, right? The first is what I'll call the establishment. And that's really, in my mind, the governments, the central banks, the policymakers, you know, the individuals who have more control over the structural elements and can kind of pull these levers that have, hopefully some macro impact. And then there is the more micro participants who are like you and I, who just, you know, are frankly trying to figure out what's going on, what's likely to happen in the future, and how to navigate those market cycles. And so if you continue thinking about the incumbents there, or kind of the structural control, there's the central banks, but there's also things like the G7, right? And recently, central bankers basically were saying, look, we can't do this all by ourselves. We need help from other people who have structural control. And I know that you were kind of providing some good fodder on that's unlikely to happen for a whole host of reasons, but maybe talk a little bit about kind of the relationship between those various groups that have that structural control, and why you think that there's unlikely to be help on the way.
Yeah, I think this is actually a hugely underreported issue, and I want to. You know, I'm not a political guy, but I am obviously an analyst, and I look at it globally in terms of what's happening on the political side. You know, we love technology. Technology has, for people like you and I, it's done fantastic things. Wouldn't live in any other time, any other place. Love it. But it also has brought about some challenges, one of which is, of course, technology being the greatest deflationary force ever. And that's where a lot of these central banks are failing. You know, it's why their policies have not worked and kind of reinflating the growth equation. The other part is demographics. That's another one that they can't change. But there's another aspect of technology that I think we all see unfold, and that's providing the big disconnect. As you said, the central banks say they themselves admit that they have limits to what they can do and that they need help from policymakers. And this is why I'm going to tie this with technology and social media, because I think it's massively important to understand this point. We all see globally, we see it in the US, we see it even in UK or Germany or wherever, we see a complete fragmentation, political fragmentation of the population. You know, when we were all younger, there was limited choices of information and news and what have you. There was a more cohesive, I'm not saying it was better or worse, I'm just saying there was a more cohesive experience of information, meaning that, you know, people had a common understanding of information from which to argue with. Technology, internet, social media, the promise was always that if you're smart, you can have a massive amount of information at your fingertips and it's going to make you a more educated person. Fantastic. I think that is true for a lot of people. Unfortunately, it's the polar opposite is also true. It's not true for a lot of people that are simply getting fed misinformation, don't, for whatever reason, are able to discern what's good information, what's bad information. And what happens is you get this massive fragmentation in the political sphere. I mean, to the point where governments are not able to come to any cohesive solutions. Structural big problems cannot be solved, cannot even be discussed, because people don't even agree on a common reality. And to me, that's actually one of the biggest structural threats that's out there, because, you know, you and I can sit together, we can look at a problem, we can decide what the problem is, and we can debate solutions. We may agree or disagree on the solutions, but at least we're going to give this a go. We're now at the point where nobody can even have a in-depth discussion about what it takes to solve issues. And that's a non-starter, because the structural issues are vastly complex. I'm not saying that there are solutions to them that are even feasible, but we're not even having debate about it. And look where we are, right? I mean, the United States is back on trillion-dollar deficits. Both Democrats and Republicans just signed this new budget deal that's going to lever this up even further. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, came out yesterday and said, well, you know what? We're going to have $1.2 trillion deficits on average for the next 10 years. And we may have 1.8% growth. Come on. You know, this is a curve to nowhere that ultimately, you know, will render all of us paralyzed, because, you know, the interest on debt will keep rising, and there's no organic growth to actually get us out of this situation. And so that's why central banks fall back to what they have been doing. Well, we need to cut rates again, and we need to add more QE. And so when you see this G7 come out this next week, and already President Macron says, well, for the first time in 44 years, we don't have a joint memo because we can't even agree on a memo, that kind of tells you what realistically actually is in the coming in terms of a coordinated policy response. It's concerning.
For sure. And so if we flip around to the other side of the market participant, which is, you know, essentially the individual investor, what are options here, right? So kind of while the chaos is happening with those who have structural control, the rest of us have to kind of push forward, right? We don't have the luxury of just kind of saying, hey, time out. What do you see as what those options are? And then kind of how do you think about navigating some of this as we go through it?
Well, we're obviously on the active side. And what we do, I don't recommend for the general investing public, because, you know, we're on both ends of the market, meaning when we see long opportunities, we go long. When we see short opportunities, we go short. And selling is hard. It's harder than buying, actually, because tops are processes, if you will. Bottoms are events, as it's often called. But you know, there are things people can do, and that is, you know, you, if you're long and you're invested, you can still have exposure to the upside, if you will. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, we may, and this is where I call this a battle of control earlier, we may still see a crazy blow off top. I mean, you know, if there's some resolution to the trade war, if central banks actually do prove they still have efficacy, if pushing these markets to new highs, you just got to know where you are in the valuation scheme, where you are in the period of the cycle. An example mentioned, and I think that was widely publicized as well, there was about Apple. Apple has the same earnings now in 2019 that it had in 2015. But the stock is almost double. Why? Because of buybacks, and they've been able to reduce their float. And so it appears that they have earnings growth per share, which they do on a reduced number of shares, but in absolute terms, they haven't grown as well. So you're now paying 17 for multiple for Apple vis-a-vis 11 or 12 4 years ago. And so, you know, as people are into passive investing, they may not even realize how expensive the underlying assets are that they actually have exposure to, right? So my view on these things is that it never hurts to have some flexibility, to create flexibility. And that means either diversification, and yes, even the famous C word, cash, because you know once the tide turns, things can get ugly very quickly, and then it's going to be very difficult to adjust. And so different asset classes, obviously that I think I've done pretty well recently is gold in 2019, as well as Bitcoin. Gold, we had a buy on in at 1277 in May because it's a big technical pattern. And, you know, to the extent that central bank's going to start printing money again, gold may keep rising as well.
And so as you look at this, is there a artificial cap on how high something like gold can go? Or do you feel like it does participate in and respond to more of a free market, right? And really what I'm talking about there is if you look at stocks, for example, given the interest rate cuts and the QE, et cetera, over a long period of time, it would be very, very hard for the entire market to not go up, right? The inflation of the asset prices is a structural situation. When it comes to gold or any of these other assets, I've seen a bunch of people, I don't know if arguing is the right word, but maybe debating, are there structural downward pressures? And some people even argue the opposite, structural kind of tailwinds for those assets that you see? Or do you feel like, no, that's probably more people bored on Twitter just kind of debating things for the sake of debating things and not really something to pay attention to?
Well, I'm ultimately a market technician, so I view any asset class through the lens of technicals, because technicals give me a sense as to shifting risk reward, right? I mean, there's times when I see something, I say, well, now, let's say I'm short on something like the market, and you know, to your point, asset classes rise over time, you know, I can make certainly a technical point and say, well, now my risk reward has shifted for all kinds of technical indicators, and I'm closing my short, and I may even be going long at this particular point in time. On stocks in particular right now, I have obviously a big structural concern because we have so many stocks, big market cap stocks that haven't really corrected in 10 years. They're massively disconnected. So I'm on the cautious side on equities, recognizing that they may still go higher because of artificial intervention again. With regards to other asset classes like gold, for example, gold itself, you know, it's gold, right? It's a commodity that's used to a certain degree in some production, but other than that, it's kept in storage vaults. So what's really the utility for it, other than obviously it used to be a currency base, and of course central banks actually hoarding it themselves. So I look at gold as purely a technical vehicle for us. That's why we had that call in May. It was a specific call, fourth 15, 20 target. And we reached that target, and now we're kind of reassessing in terms of the global picture on gold. So, you know, when we get to a particular point, we shift risk reward. I don't look at it in terms of, you know, unlimited price advances from a structural perspective. I just look at it from a technical perspective, which is actually where Bitcoin is kind of interesting too, because I've been charting a little bit on Bitcoin this year, and it was interesting what I've seen there, because it does react technically, and that's the primary interest for me in any trading vehicle. Does it act technically or not?
And so elaborate a little bit more on what you've seen as you've charted Bitcoin and kind of started paying more attention this year.
Well, obviously, last year we had that massive move to 20,000, right? That's why you had the big sentiment move, and you know, the futures contract got in, and then they had this big, massive correction, which I think historically, when you look at it, obviously is not unusual. But of course, you know, for anyone participating in cryptos, you know, there's massive volatility, and it's a service, a product that is currently kind of, I view it as in an early adopter phase, which means that there are still maybe unproven things about the business model. At the same time, you have a lot of people like yourself who see a lot of potential in it and are big believers. And so there's a price discovery process. And when you look at the chart on Bitcoin specifically, you can draw some very clean structures and patterns. And it's very impressive. I mean, we had basically, the correction from 2018 highs to these lows late in the year formed what we call technically a falling wedge. Very clean, broke out of this wedge this year, pushed higher into, I don't want to get too technical here, but we had a 0.618 FIB retracement from the highs in 2018 to the lows, and it was perfect. And I just, you know, I highlighted this even on Twitter, just had a correction from there. And so you see these technicals working. And what I see now at the moment, which is not confirmed yet, but it's a bull flag that's building. I see it. I think it's dropping a little bit below 10,000 right now. Still has room lower on that bull flag. But that bull flag, if it plays, and it wouldn't confirm until it breaks above the upper wedge of that flag, has potential this year at least to go into 16,000. At which point, obviously, we're overtly close to the previous highs. And then it gets interesting, because then once you get above that, then you have a much larger technical target out there.
For sure. And now, one of the things that I've really tried to understand, and I do not have kind of the technical chops that you have when it comes to charts, et cetera. And so I'm thinking a little bit more in the kind of macro trends of these assets. But I'd love to hear your perspective on the difference from traditional markets, where there's much more electronic trading algorithms and machines at work, versus in the Bitcoin or crypto markets, where it just doesn't seem like there's that much of that going on yet. And so there's more of a kind of pure retail psychology at play. And you get what appears to be much cleaner technical analysis. Does that line up with what you've seen in both the traditional markets and in this market, or am I maybe thinking about that incorrectly?
Just from what I've seen so far, I mean, obviously, yes, in equities and in, you know, the big index, it's amazing what's going on in terms of the algorithmic and computerized trading. And I always say, you know, yeah, we've all been taught this and that and the other about technical analysis. I think we always need to keep a keen view of how things are changing. And that's why I call it navigating changing markets, because they are changing all the time. And the key challenge for anyone is to figure out what is relevant, because, you know, it doesn't matter what you and I think, right? What an asset should be trading at is what matters, what it actually does. And these algos and computerized programs, they are exactly that. They're also following specific instructions. And so what I always look for is, okay, where do the algos live? What do they find relevant? And yes, I find these points where you go, okay, this is a, and I find trend lines to be incredibly effective. You may get these occasional overthrows, like you get them like a stop run that comes, you know, people have position stops there, and then all of a sudden you get price extensions to the up or downside. But you know, these patterns form on not only the long term, but also on the short term. And you can see it daily, even on the shorter term timeframes when we have kind of consolidation periods. I mean, it's almost laughable because they're so precise in how they revert on a particular point, and you can see it in advance. I mean, that's great for us traders, you know, if you want to kind of play the day-to-day action, but it's so obvious basically that it tells you a lot of this has nothing to do with real valuation or price discovery in any shape or form. As I said earlier, there's a lot of participants in these markets that may not even be human, that don't care how much they pay, how much value they get. It's just basically programming's pinging back and forth. And what I mentioned about Bitcoin before, you know, I'm not looking at it every day, to be honest. So I just look at the macro chart, and I just say from now, what I've seen in 2019, it's acted very technically, and I find that impressive at this point.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty crazy when you see folks who have less kind of qualitative attachment to these assets, specifically Bitcoin, and come from the traditional markets, are more technical in their analysis. And then they look at this asset and the upside potential that they look at, both in the short term and in the long term, it's quite impressive, frankly, right? And I continue to tell various folks that I talk with that even if they're wrong by 50%, right, the numbers and the magnitude of movements that we're talking about, both short and long term, are just not available in other markets, right? And so you've got to look at that as they can go in your favor or against you, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean just because there's massive movements, that's a positive. But if you're on the right side of those investments or trades, obviously there's a lot of potential value capture there.
Yeah, the volatility is back, right? I remember last year, obviously, when it went through that big correction, there was a period of, I recall, of several months, it really wasn't doing anything, right? It was just kind of meandering and basing. And that, you get that with assets as well. But then if you're on the right side of a breakout, these things can absolutely move, you know? And I think, you know, Bitcoin, you know, looking at it in the probably in the more broader structure, you know, ultimately these alternate currencies may pose a threat to, or maybe already viewed as a threat to the existing currency system. And, you know, rightfully so, because, you know, every currency is a complete mess at the moment, right?
For sure. What is the one surprise that you think could happen over the next 12 to 24 months in the macro economy that maybe people aren't talking about and should be?
Well, I mean, you know, again, I'm looking at it from kind of perspective, what can go wrong against my thesis, for example. My thesis has been, I think equities are massively overvalued, and, you know, we're hanging on a string here macroeconomically. I mean, I think ultimately right now, from a psychology perspective, the how this trade war plays out is massively important, because you could see, it could be something as simple as a tweet by Donald Trump saying, you know, he's going to let go of the tariffs for now, and he's going to roll them back. I mean, you would have just a massive, massive melt up, I think, in stock markets. Why? Because there's so much uncertainty right now in the globe in terms of investments. They don't know. This is one of the problems why we see all these slowdowns in manufacturing and hiring or what have you. There's no policy certainty about what's going to happen. So that's kind of an upside risk factor. How realistic that is, I'm not clear, because I see no comprehensive strategy to bring these two parties together. They're very far apart. They've put themselves both now in a position where they can risk losing face to their own respective audiences. And I think that makes compromise very difficult. So it becomes then a question of who's got the upper hand here, who can hold out the longest. And that's obviously a completely separate debate. I think on the downside is simply, you know, are we all kind of in, I see a lot of recession denial out there. I mean, I see it from Wall Street. I see it from central bankers. I see it from politicians. Like this weekend, we saw it from the side of the administration, right? Kudlow and folks came out in Navarro, said, oh, there's no risk of recession. Oh, by the way, we're talking to donors and preparing them for a recession, right? So this goes back to this whole optimism game. And I wonder if there's a trigger that we all can't really foresee that ultimately brings that about a lot faster than any of us think at the moment. That's the risk. So I think we're in a very critical phase of markets. Can they push asset prices higher one more time with intervention programs, massive rate cuts in September, or are they starting to lose control and something happens and we're basically right sizing again? And from a Fed's perspective, let me just add this point here is I think they're mad to cut rates here, having only 8 rate cuts left. As you said at the outset, 500 basis points were required to deal with the last recession. They're playing with fire because if you do have an earnest turn and all these confidence measures are not working, what are they really going to do? How are they really going to stop the downturn? And that's the big unanswered question for all of us.
For sure. All right. Before I finish up, I usually ask some rapid fire questions, and I wish we could just talk forever because we think very similarly, and this is super fascinating to me. What's the most important book that you've ever read?
Ah, I'm a historian. I know
that's why I'm excited to hear.
there's so many historical books I've read from the ancient Roman times. I love the ancient Roman period. The ancient writers have so much to offer. I would everybody recommend that. Even Julius Caesar. I mean, the Gallic Wars. I mean, that's obviously not related to markets, but it's related to strategy, and that's always a good lesson to learn in any environment. So, no trading books for you, unfortunately.
That's all right. And then the other question is aliens. Believer, non-believer?
I think we are the aliens.
I love that. Why do you think that?
I mean, look at us. We've taken over the planet. We're ruining it. That's what aliens would do, right?
Absolutely. I saw recently, I think it was yesterday, I guess there's a fire in the Amazon forest. And
there's 10,000 fires.
Yeah, it's huge. And the thing that I saw was, you know, when the Notre Dame building went into flames, every single media organization in the world rushed to cover it, and people couldn't stop talking about it. And you know, it's a historic building, and there's importance, and it's, you know, near people geographically and things like that. So it's very visual. But to see what's going on in the Amazon today, and to see that there's much less coverage, much less interest, it's I think pretty telling about just humans in general and kind of our relationship with the planet.
Oh, it's massive. I mean, if you've never done this, try this. Finding Google satellite images of, you look at major metropolitan areas over the last even just 30 years, you know, and see how they have expanded. It's massive. I mean, if you want to be philosophical about it, you can say, hey, well, this looks like there's a virus spreading on this planet, right? I mean, you mentioned Brazil. You know, we got these massive ice melting in Greenland. I mean, you know, at some point you have to kind of acknowledge reality here that climate is changing. It's changing rapidly. Now, the planet has gone through lots of changes before, but we are 7.5 billion going on 8 billion, and we're leaving a footprint, and it's very visible and it's very real. So that also brings in a cost for the economy, but it also brings opportunities, right? If you can apply technology to really dramatically change our footprint, I think that's an opportunity for investors as well, because these changes are real, and we see them every summer. Unfortunately, it gets hotter.
For sure. I end every podcast letting the guests ask me one question after they've patiently sat and answered all of mine. Any question you have for me?
Yes. How do you handle distractors on Twitter? It's always a fun subject for me.
So this is one of my favorite topics, mainly because my strategy has evolved over time. In the beginning, I responded to everybody, right? And just, if you were a detractor, you just were a future fan who didn't realize it yet. And what you realize, you know, over time, I think, is just there are a lot of really great people on Twitter. They have really good intentions, but there are a few, you know, I'll call them the bad apples from an analogy standpoint. And they just either are unhappy, their strategy is to attack people and argue and do all this stuff. And so one of my partners told me, when he first joined Twitter, he got the advice, block and mute early and often. And so for the longest time, I fought doing that because I was scared of creating the echo chamber and all of that. And so now what I essentially do is I use the mute button. So it's like, look, you can say whatever you want. If I come across it when I'm reading through something, that's fine. But if you're just going to consistently be the negative Nancy in the room and kind of be overly detracting and kind of aggressive, I'm just not here for that, right? And so those two features have become much more valuable to me over time compared to when I first started and frankly, just answered everybody, which was, very interesting and definitely led to some stories of you're shocked at what people will say on the internet when their name's not attached to it.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's been a fascinating ride and experience for me as well. I agree with a lot of what you just said. I mean, I try to engage as much as I can, but obviously you can't respond to everybody, and there's very limited time for negativity and hate. And I just don't understand why people are oftentimes focused on that, but that's unfortunately part of the human equation as well. But bottom line, I think it's a fantastic medium. And it's a great way to communicate if people choose to use it that way.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, sir, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I think people will really enjoy hearing your perspectives. So thanks so much. We'll have to do it again in the future as all this plays out.
Thanks, Pomp. It was great.
Hey, everyone. Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.